So welcome everybody, and great chat this morning. Let's begin as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation. Then we'll take refuge together and generate a mind of enlightenment. So get comfortable in your seats. Make sure your back is straight and your shoulders are relaxed. And as you continue to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that take place in your lower abdomen or the upper chest whenever you inhale or exhale. And while the body begins to relax and the mind settle down and become calm, think that all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appear in the space above your head, and that all sentient beings are seen to be sitting and surrounding you. And acknowledge the sameness between ourselves and all sentient beings, and the sameness between ourselves and all the enlightened beings. We think that because of the nature of the mind being mere clarity and empty, we have this opportunity to become fully awakened, just like all the Buddhas, and to bring about our own welfare and the welfare of everyone else. To bring about that welfare, we need to engage in the practice of the perfections. I think, you know, we're studying the perfections, in particular the perfection of joyous perseverance, so that we can persevere joyously in our study and practice of the Dharma to bring about our welfare and the welfare of every other living being. And this being our intention, and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas knowing of it, think that they start to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure. That an emanation leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing the same direction you are. The emanation descends, entering the crown of your head, coming down to rest at your heart. The radiance of its body begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light. The light goes out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. And wherever sentient beings abide within that space, they are touched by that light and transformed into being fully awakened beings. There's no difference between self and other. In fact, the boundaries between self and other have completely vanished. The boundaries between inner and outer have also disappeared. And we just rest in our original nature. Then the mind moves from this state of tranquility with the recollection that we have become enlightened to benefit all beings. This is the point of all our practices. And with this idea that all the light begins to withdraw, re-entering at the level of the heart, you feel yourself breathing normally and naturally in your chair. And I think this was just an exercise in imagination. I actually have to become enlightened. I need to engage in the practice of the perfections and bring about my own enlightenment for the benefit of others. And to do that, I'm going to take refuge in the three jewels and generate a mind of enlightenment. So taking refuge together. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then to stabilize the wish and to make it stronger, we can recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So to accomplish enlightenment for all beings, we need to abandon everything that hinders it and engage in everything that gives rise to that enlightenment. All these practices are summed up in the seven limb prayer, so we can recite that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So the major hindrances to enlightenment is the clinging to the body and clinging to the self-grasping mind. So think if we can just let those go, in their absence, wonderful pure land appears, which we offer to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They think that this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field of effort. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiratayami. The Buddhas accept the offerings and they smile at us in delight. And we witness that delight and take pleasure in it, and in that way engage in our study of the Dharma. So then take a deep breath in through your nostrils and exhale through your mouth and allow yourself to be present in your seat and in front of your screen. Okay, I'll begin the class by starting our first slide. So, so we come up to class 22. I think this might be three or four, I think, in terms of the perfection we're studying. And here are the texts. Of course, we're really coming off the commentary of Khinsa Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Sering. And that's coming from here, the great treatise on the stages of the path by Lama Tsongkhapa, the Lama Rinchenmo. And the most comprehensive published commentary we have on that is this one here by Geshe Sopa, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. The other books are also very useful and could also sort of complement our understanding. And you're probably also aware that, that these books here, like these books by the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chogyam, especially the new one that's just come out called Courageous Compassion, and it has Venerable Aryatara on the cover. So that's really getting into detail on the perfections also. So they're they're all useful, and you can draw upon them to flesh your understanding out a bit more. So today we're still on this method of development. If you've gone through the questions, you'll see basically we're still going over material that we covered last week. It's just a bit more in depth. There's about 14 questions, and we'll be looking at their answers today. So the first question is about these divisions that are under the method for developing joyous effort. So the first is to eliminate unfavorable conditions that prevent joyous perseverance, and then to gather the forces of the favorable conditions. So you see that this methodology is really common to the presentation of the path. You find out what hinders you and you abandon it, and then you gather everything in to bring about the result. So there's always like abandonment and adoption. And you can even see that in the title of Buddha, Sangha, purify first, then develop all the good qualities. So same here. Find all the conditions that prevent joyous perseverance and abandon them, and then gather everything that will help you develop it and and accomplish joyous perseverance. Which leads us now to being intent on joyously persevering. And finally, how to use joyous perseverance to make the mind and body serviceable. And then we've got some questions to do with the essence of each of these categories. And I thought that it was quite difficult, wasn't it? I mean, if you've gone through this and tried to go, what is the essential point of each of these things? It's not easy to draw that out. And in Kintsa Rinpoche's commentary, it's like a sentence. I guess you have to sort of find that sentence and break it up and go, gee, is that what they're actually asking? So this is where I found it very useful to go to Geshe Sopa's book and you find more material there. So let's have a look at, first of all, eliminating unfavorable conditions that prevent joyous perseverance. Now, so this is not going to stop. So don't get distracted by it.
No, if you need it to stop, you just have to hold your hand up.
So the blue fellow here is, the things that are hindering joyous perseverance, and you've got to throw it over.
Again and again and again.
Again and again. Yeah. So here Geshe Sopa says, the essence of this section is to first identify all the factors incompatible with joyous perseverance and then employ methods to eliminate those incompatible factors. So the factors incompatible with joyous perseverance are laziness, adhering to what is ignoble, and self-contempt out of discouragement. So we need to get rid of those hindrances to perseverance. In other words, eliminate laziness. And then on the positive side, develop all the necessary conditions for perseverance. Identify the types of laziness, apply antidotes. And when you look at the Lamrim Chenma itself, those are two sort of headings about this topic. So that's the real essential point here. Now we need to, like I said, identify the types of laziness and then learn how to fight against them. So that's why I put the fight. Okay, let's have a look at the next one. Gathering what's favorable. So I think this was called on. The question is, what's the essence of gathering the forces of the favorable conditions? So again, I'll read up what Geshe Sopa had to say, and then I'll put them up there. So the essence of gathering the forces of the favorable conditions is to develop the four positive conditions called the four powers. And that you could just, if you put that down there, that would be enough. That's the essence of it. But then Lama Geshe Sopa goes on to add a bit more to it. So he says, these are the power of aspiration, steadfastness, joy, and relinquishment. He says, we have to learn how to use these four powers to create the necessary conditions to produce perseverance that was not there before and maintain the perseverance that we already have. To bring about perseverance initially, we need the power of aspiration. So as you know, the aspiration is a wish. We wish to joyously persevere. Once we produce perseverance, then we use the power of steadfastness to keep it from degenerating. While we're in the middle of working on a practice, we use the power of joy to keep from giving up. And the fourth power, the power of relinquishment, shows us how to rest for a little while when we are tired, and then immediately go back to work when we are refreshed.
So, Eddie, that one seems a key, because being unable to actually rest when you need to means people burn out and then can't do anything.
Yeah, that's right.
So to be able to rest without guilt or to rest with a purpose.
Yeah. That's right. So, so reading them, sorry, Fran?
Ask, is it physical rest or mental rest that we're talking about?
It could be both. You'll need to have a mental rest, definitely, because as you know, even just familiarizing yourself with this material, it's tiring. And as Khenpo Rinpoche said, meditation, meaning becoming familiar with this material, is tiring. So in terms of meditating, I like the advice that B. Alan Wallace says, 24-minute sessions. Don't do more than that, because at least for us, if you consider yourself a beginner, don't do more than 24 minutes. Do less, but not more.
What if you don't have 24 minutes?
As I say, so you do less, friend.
Yeah.
Right, so one of the things, my particular take on it, is to work out the least amount of effort you could put into your Dharma practice. And the least amount of effort I've put up is 1% of my day. And 1% of the day is 15 minutes. So if you can't give 15 minutes to Dharma practice, gee, it's going to be a long time to get lighted then, isn't it? And the other thing I thought of is, at our class, one of our other classes we're doing is on the discovering Buddhism on understanding the mind. There are 51 or 52 mental factors there.
51.
So if you just put aside the 5 ever-present mental factors and the 5 object ascertaining mental factors, just for starters, then you have 6 root afflictions, 20 subsequent afflictions, and 11 virtuous minds. Right? So 20, 31, 37. So if you gave yourself a week to learn about each one of them, by the end of the year, you'd know those 52 mental factors. And you consider people like you and I, Fran, that have been doing this for a long time, right? Like, I couldn't tell you about each one of those mental factors right now. I'm sure you couldn't either, Fran. Yet we've been here for 20 years, right, studying Buddha Dharma. So there's I would suggest there's been something missing in our methodology of training ourselves. And so one of the things I like to... The West has come up with some very good study techniques. So for these, during the week, I took out, I thought I'll start with the root afflictions. So I just took out desirous attachment and, find it. What's the definition of it? What are the divisions of it? How do you actually become desire? How does desirous attachment manifest within your mind? And then what are the antidotes? Right, so you just take a week and go, that's all I'm interested in this week. I'm just going to do 1% of my time. It's 7 times 15 minutes minimum. Believe me, at the end of the week, you should know what desirous attachment is, shouldn't you? Have the divisions, know how it arises, and what the antidotes are. And then the next week, you do the next one. And to say 1% today, I'm just going to spend just on knowing about these root ones. Meanwhile, I'll keep reading and studying, but I'm going to definitely put in 15 minutes a day.
I guess the problem is, this instant gratification thing that we have, and we don't have that. I want it all to happen yesterday, it's all about for me to calm my mind down to sort of get it into a state where I can appreciate the fact that it's going to take a lot longer than what I imagine it will.
Eddie, also what you're saying, it seems like it's also to do with pacing yourself. So you're saying take it in bite-sized chunks, not too onerous, but really specific bite-sized chunks, and then that way just that little incremental progress does actually add up. On the other hand, like when we were talking about the relinquishment, I remember Geshe Zopa saying, in the monastery, the people that would study really hard, be incredibly bright academically at the top of their class. Even when they were doing their chores in the kitchen, they'd be there with their study books and everyone would think, oh, they're going to go places. And the older tutors would say, no, not necessarily, because what would happen is they'd burn out because they wouldn't actually have a mental rest. So when they're doing the chores, they were still studying on the side. So there was, they just went, and then blew up and, you know, gave up their ordination or quit their studies. And all of that, you know, 10 years of study, you know, just fell by the wayside then from going too hard and not pacing yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so all of, you know, we're all, there's no Sangha here, so we're all lay people. One of the things I do is like I'll do my 15 to 24 minute study and then I'll go and do the dishes. And that's my little break. You know, and then I come back, do this, then I might go outside, clean up the cat poo. Right? Then I come back in again. It's just like getting your break. And sometimes, you know, like an hour, 2 hours go by, I'm tired. So then I just lie down and do breathing meditation with on my tummy. Then you come back up again, okay, just go back to work again. So we definitely need this, the power of the force of relinquishment, putting down the mind for a little while, just getting it to rest for a little while and then coming back to it. The other thing, so, you know, Miffy's got a great way, and I do this myself, is that whenever you get stuck, just stop and like, go to sleep. Just rest.
Go and because do what you find else.
Is your mind just solves it.
Yeah, so part of it, I think in our culture too, we think that if we're not overtly doing something, we're not doing anything. Whereas actually just sitting and resting and letting things settle is doing something.
Bruce, you're going to say something?
Yeah, just about that time when you do stop, when you think this is not working or my mind's all over the shop and I can't focus and that sort of thing. I sometimes think, yeah, I need a break, I'm going to have a break, I'll come back to it when my mind's settled a bit. And then at other times I think, no, this is the sort of stuff I need to be able to discipline the mind a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I still don't know sometimes what the right approach is.
You've got to do it kindly.
Yeah, but I thought if I do it kindly all the time, I'll never overcome this sort of scattered brain, you know. Scattered mind.
Yeah, it's one of the things, you know, I think one of the things to remember, Bruce, is that so there isn't a single method that works all the time. Right? So sometimes it's like the resting thing works, and that's great, you do that. Then you find, you know, it's not changing, so then you have to put more effort in. And you'll find that that the times the method works also changes. So just got to be sort of open, I guess, to the methodologies. So there's times, you know, we need to exert ourselves, but there's other times we need to rest. And we need to discover that for ourselves, and it's through trial and error. Because, you know, each one of us, the path is individual, isn't it? For each one of us. I mean, I'm not doing Sue's path. She's not doing mine. I don't do Bruce's. Bruce, you don't do mine. Yeah, I mean, all the literature's there, but you still have to work out what works for you. And the only way to do that is by trying it. So, you know, relinquishment, it's an important one. Yeah, so take the breaks, get the cup of coffee or drink more water, anything that'll keep you persevering sort of happily.
So by relinquishing, we're more or less, you know, cutting desire, aren't we? You know, because it can be a bit painful to give up things, you know, and depending what we're trying to give up. So, yeah, so for me, you know, because you want everything, you know, and you want to be good and you want to, you know, you want to be the best student, you want to do this, you want to do that. So giving up the idea of it can be a little bit uncomfortable for me. And so, but I need to sort of see that it sort of fits in well with you know, cutting attachment to stuff.
Well, yeah, like I was saying before, we've got to work out, you work out what doesn't work. That's the first thing. So you just don't do that anymore. You just abandon what doesn't work. So if you know that, yeah, like I was saying, for you and I, Fran, right? So I've been here more than 20 years studying. And like I said, we haven't even got the 52 things down. Like, just think about what we could have learned in 20 years if we were methodical about it. If we had a method that didn't make us go for this, you know, perfection all at once. You know, like when we eat a meal, don't you? You don't just pick up the plate and just put it down and it's done. You eat your meal fork by fork, forkful by forkful, isn't it? You know, actually, what was that? What did they say? Bird by bird. One
bird at
bite.
A time.
One bird at a time. And if we only just did one bird at a time, we'd be much further ahead.
Yeah, see, the crazy deluded mind I have is telling me, well, you've had 20 years, lovey, what are you doing, you know, sort of thing. So once again, it's that for me to be kind to myself to say, look, I've just got to start where I am. And, you know, because, yeah.
And like I said, find a technique that works for you. We actually do. We still got to do our dharma. Like I said, if I ask you, how much dharma do you do a day? Yeah, we'll say, well, an actual structured dharma when I'm home studying or meditating, it's this long. And I'd suggest, you know, is that 1% of your whole day? Is it 2%? And then, you know, and then we go about our daily lifetime and we try and incorporate our dharma into ordinary life. Right? So it's not like dharma and then life. Our what we understand about dharma should pervade life, our lives. And you know, one of the simplest ways, isn't it, is to, like it's saying here, is when you wake up in the morning, be so grateful, joyful that you're still alive and you have this opportunity to develop virtue, mm-hmm. make, you know, a great life for yourself and help others do the same. You know, rejoice that we've met the Buddha Dharma. Rejoice that we've met some teachers. Rejoice that we've even got faith in this business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that'll just take you 2 or 3 minutes, won't it? But we should do this, like, again and again and again until we actually have what you'll see later on, I think in the next slide, is to be able to joyously persevere. You know, like we love the life we've got. We're doing meaningful work that's, like, it's great. Purposeful, meaningful work. Now let's go on to the next slide. Let's see. So being intent on persevering. So the question is, based on the elimination of the unfavorable conditions and the accumulation of favorable conditions, what's the essence of being intent on joyously persevering? That's the question being asked of us. And the actual answer is really simple. The essence is knowing how to practice joyously. It's really simple. That's the essence. And as I said, the easy way to do this is wake up in the morning, be glad you're alive, be glad you've met a teacher, be glad you've come across the Dharma, be glad that there's a Sangha practicing Dharma, and that you're living a meaningful and purposeful life. So we just know how to practice. We know how to persevere joyously. Because we know, don't we, that there's some people who dread life, get up in the morning and it's like, oh no, another day. But like I said, this doesn't have to be the case with us. I was actually saying last night, Venerable Lhasa and I went off to get a takeaway dinner. We had to wait about 3/4 of an hour for it. And I was just saying to like how wonderful it is that we know about the Dharma, that we can sit there and never be bored. We've always got something to do. It's always valuable. Yeah, we've got all this technology, all these mental techniques, that wherever we are, we can do stuff without the assistance of anybody. And I said, you know, how few people in the world have that? The fourth one is being serviceable. So the question, what's the essence of how to use joyous perseverance to make the body and mind serviceable? Well, basically, it's this. They actually become serviceable, meaning the body and mind become workable and easy to control.
So, Eddie, as a way of telling if we're on the right track, it should be that the more we study Dharma, the happier we become studying Dharma. So, the more you study, the more cranky and uptight you become.
Yeah, you know, you can look at it from two perspectives. One thing is we should be less miserable. On the other side, we should be more happy. We should be happier people. Less miserable, happier people. Because the Dharma is actually to work against misery and its sources, isn't it? I mean, that's what the Buddha said. All I teach you is what suffering is and how to abandon it. And I also show you the true paths that bring about, you know, the liberation from suffering and its result. And of course, you know, this will often take a bit of time, won't it? It's like, you know, can you look back, as His Holiness often says, his advice, look back after 5 years. Are you less miserable? Are you more happy? Does your life seem to have more purpose and meaning? If you can answer yes to those questions, you're on the right track. Okay, so now we have the next slide is about this qualm. So you'll see in the Labrum Chenmo, various qualms or questions arise. And I remember when we first studied this up at Chen Resnik Institute so many years ago, this was the part that I really didn't like. You know? But now it's like the part I really like, because it's really, you know, somebody's going to pound the question and go, yeah, but what about this? And you think, that's just the sort of question I could have, or some one of the students will ask. And then they answer it. So let's have a look at this qualm. And it's about giving away the body. You know? So he says, so how do we answer this qualm that this is a very difficult path, because practitioners are required to give away their body? So anybody like to see any suggestions here? So a big clue here with the fruit, with the veggies on the screen. Anybody like to, what do you think?
Practice generosity.
Yes, we do. We will be practicing generosity, and this is this thing. So what they are saying here, Fran, is one of the practices of generosity is to give away your body. Now, that's too difficult. I can't.
To science, when you die, I'll give it away.
I can't do that. That's too hard. Right? Well, so how do we get around that sort of qualm? That's what's sort of been asked here.
Well, it's not going to happen straight away.
Yep, that's right.
That's an unreasonable expectation.
That's right. And so as it's not going to happen straight away, Bruce, follow on from that?
Eventually, yeah, as you progress on the path, you might approach that ability.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's right. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, look, there's really no need to worry about that, because you have to work up to it. And with respect, you know, to the body, you don't have to give it away at the beginning And in fact, you don't give it away for quite some time. But through the graduated training in generosity, you can bring your attachment to the body to an end. And then you'll have no difficulty giving the body away. But until that's done, you can't give it away. So we have to overcome attachment and strengthen the force of our generosity and great compassion. Then we can give the body away.
We can do it. We can give away the body in imagination, though, can't we? I mean,
yes,
we can
practice it
in our, you know, mandala offering. And
yeah, that's right. So there are different. Yeah, that's right. You can actually practice to do that. In fact, Lama Zopa made a really lovely practice on this for the time of dying. Do you remember that in that red book where you give away the elements of the body?
Yeah, you imagine all of the elements of your body. So, you know, the all the fluid in the body turning into rivers of nectar. And he also threw in an infinite cans of Fanta and Coca-Cola and champagne. And so your whole body dissolves into the elements and you, practice giving that away. And it's beautiful because it actually, you know, stops that fear.
Yeah. So Geshe Sopa said, so this is on page 444 in volume 3, when the strength of our compassion for others is so extensive that we love them more than ourselves, we turn away from attachment to our own body. Only at that point, and only if we determine that giving a part of our body to others will serve a greater purpose than keeping it, should we do it. Now, this is not something done unthinkingly. Bodhisattvas must see that it would be meaningful to help others this way. The measure of this level of practice is being able to give your body your life as easily as giving a vegetable.
Sounds like signing up to be an organ donor.
Yeah, well, that'd be a very easy time, isn't it, then? Yeah. Yeah, so just as you pointed out, Bruce, so we don't do it just straight away just because we've taken the bodhisattva vow, or that before you even take it, you realize, oh, you're ready to go, oh my God, no, I can't do that. And you say, yeah, you're right, you can't do that right now. But it's possible to train yourself in such a way that you could give it later on. And even then, you should only give it if it serves a great purpose.
So Chris has said, so giving blood, donating a kidney, so those kind of things, actually, it's extraordinary that we have the ability to be able to do that in, you know, like that. Yeah. We must have made an amount of merit to be able to create merit like that of actually giving our parts of our body.
This is one of the reasons why it's that we can become enlightened, because we've already got the basis. So people do that without having bodhicitta, without taking refuge in the Buddha Dharma, do they? Don't they? Right, so that's, and why do they do it? Out of compassion. They realize their own son or somebody else is suffering a great deal, and they would benefit greatly by having this organ, and they're willing to give up the organ. And so, like I said, ordinary people do that. So, yeah, we're sort of ordinary people, but then we've just taken on this vow, and then suddenly it becomes much more powerful. If you have the bodhisattva vow, or the intention to bring about enlightenment for yourself and all beings, and you give your kidney or some blood, that is a much more powerful action than giving your blood or kidneys just to help others. Now, there's a our next question is asking about the different sections here. So the question is, what's the third section under stopping discouragement or self-contempt? So we have these three sections, and here they are. The first was stopping discouragement about the goal, stopping discouragement about the means to attain the goal, and the last was stopping discouragement because wherever you are is a place to practice. So it's this third one that they're really honing in on, which brings us up to this next qualm that we have. So this qualm is reaching Buddhahood requires taking limitless rebirths in cyclic existence. So I will be harmed by the suffering therein. I'm not capable of that. You know, so I'm sure for most of us, when it came to Buddhism, and most people you know who know anything about Buddhism will think that the real goal here is liberation, is you just want to get out. So it's personal liberation that they'll be familiar with. And I'm sure most of us would have come into this with the same idea. But you know that the bodhisattva path is not larger than that. This will say, no, I wish to come back to cyclic existence again and again and again until cyclic existence is emptied. Right, so then if you think about it, you know, it's natural to think, oh my God, hang on a minute. I want to get out because of all the suffering, because it's so unpleasant. And you guys who say to me, now you've got to come back again and again and again. I don't want to do that. That's terrible. Terrible idea. And that's the sort of qualm that's been put forth. So that's the qualm, and then it's asked, so how's this qualm answered? So Lama Tsongkhapa in the Lama of Chinwa, this is on page 191 in volume 2, says, reflect as follows. Bodhisattvas have eliminated all sin. Therefore, the effect of sin, the feeling of suffering, will not arise because they have stopped the cause. Through firm knowledge that cyclic existence lacks an intrinsic nature, like a magician's illusion, they also have no mental suffering. So Geshe Sopa elaborates on this in his book on page 445. He says, in relationship to this qualm, you know, Buddhahood requires limitless rebirths and cyclic existence. I'm going to be harmed every time I'm in cyclic existence. I'm not capable of doing that. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, to reverse this self-defeating attitude, we should think along the following lines. Suffering in samsara is the result of negative karma. Negative karma, harming others to gain our own ends, is founded on ignorance. Powerful, self-centered attachment to our body and possessions leads to jealousy and the other mental afflictions. These, in turn, impel us to do many negative things to others. But bodhisattvas completely change that pattern. In the past, they cherished themselves, but now they have great compassion, love, and a spontaneous desire to attain enlightenment in order to benefit others. Bodhicitta leads them to dedicate everything they do to benefit other sentient beings. As a result, not only do they not create negative karma, all their actions are virtuous. Since there is no cause of suffering, there is no suffering result. Wholesome karma brings a fortunate life of happiness, peace, and enjoyment. So even though bodhisattvas may appear to be ordinary human beings, because of their wisdom and compassion, they do not experience samsaric suffering in the same way that ordinary beings do. But so, of course, remember here that you can have there's bodhisattvas on the paths of accumulation, preparation, seeing, and so forth. And so there's still degrees of suffering the bodhisattvas experience, but not in the way that normally that ordinary beings would. So this is a qualm, reaching Buddhahood. It's a natural...
Eddie, can you read it out, please?
So reaching Buddhahood requires taking limitless rebirths in cyclic existence. So I'll be harmed by the suffering therein. I'm not capable of that. So like I said, but people who engage in the Buddhist spiritual path would go, I don't want to take rebirth in cyclic existence again and again, limitlessly over and over. I want to get out altogether. Yeah, yep, so that's the paths of the lower beings, isn't it? The Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas, those who are seeking their own personal liberation. They say, I just want out, thanks. Everyone that's a big ask, to come back and suffer again and again, that's too much to ask of me. But to liberate myself, I think I can do that. So we need to have that thinking process where we go by, I need to liberate myself from cyclic existence. We need to do that. But then we need to take this next step, whereby that we see that, hang on a minute, there's no, you know, we're all the same here. There's no difference between myself and others. Every other being has been a mother, a father, a son, a daughter, a child to me. They've all helped me. Da, 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 da. You know, work out actually, taking rebirth limitless times within psychic existence doesn't mean they'll have the normal sufferings of ordinary beings. So I'll do one more question, one more slide, and then we'll have a little break because our first hour's up pretty quickly, isn't it? Does anybody have anything to say about this qualm at all?
Eddie, just close the screen share so you can see people if they're waving at you.
This thing of desperation going on around in my mind about wanting to get out of samsara, you know, and we're actually visually seeing it with the people wanting to get out of Afghanistan at the moment, you know, that desperate struggle, you know, to just get out of one place that's causing great suffering. But the thing is, you know, it's much bigger than that anyway.
Yeah, but it's not a bad analogy, isn't it? Because imagine getting out and then you leave your mother, your brother, your sisters back in Afghanistan.
And you can see how just even that's right, that when people are saying, I'm glad I'm out, but I feel so sad for my country. So that's a natural thing to...
Yeah. And that's a similar type of thing that we're here to do, isn't it? With moving from an individual path of liberation to the much more vaster path of the Mahayana and go universal emancipation.
It was on the radio this morning, they interviewed a woman who'd been working on a education project for young girls in Afghanistan, and she's decided to stay behind and sort of go underground with this education program. And I thought, yeah, well, taking that analogy a bit further, she's
That's right.
Going the full bodhisattva.
Yeah, that's right. But,
you know,
I can't. Yeah,
putting yourself at great risk, you know.
So, you know, like I said, even people without the Buddha Dharma can have this sort of real compassion for the others, aren't they? You know, so as people, you know, as Lama Tsongkhapa is pointing out too here, you can sort of see, actually, there's all these great methods here. You know, like, so the woman who's going to stay there, so natural, deep compassion for others, but at the same time, no access to all these other methods to help her. And, yet, you know, we have the access to the methods. So our next question, so before I put the slide up, is a sort of a simple one. So I'll just ask you guys. So the question is, where do our problems come from? I know we could give many different types of answers here. What's the answer that was put forward by Geshe-la? Anyone? So where do our problems come from? And there are two things that are the source of our problems. What are the sources of our problems? Anyone?
So he said there were two, the inability to abandon our attachment to our bodies and our inability to realize emptiness.
Excellent. Thank you, Linda.
Nice.
That's right. Attached. So let's have a look. Attachment to the body, and just as Linda said, an inability to realize that phenomena are like illusions. So this takeaway, this understanding that phenomena are like illusions, arises from your understanding that phenomena lack the inherent existence they appear to have. So in that way, phenomena are like illusions. So the other day, maybe yesterday or something, somehow or other, I got to think about rainbows. So a little while ago, Miffy and I went down to South Park, and this was an amazing day. So they had a double rainbow in the sky.
We went down to South Park with Cartman and Kenny.
We all looked at the rainbows.
Ready?
And Cartman made fun of us. But yeah, like you think of it, when you look up at a rainbow, it's like it really looks like there's something real up there, doesn't there? Yeah, there's a real shape, real colour. And that shape and colour are rising dependent upon sunshine, reflected raindrops, is it? But there's no, so even though it looks like it's there, in fact, if you went like there, you wouldn't find anything there. Anyway, I was thinking about you know, so I started laughing. I thought, wow, you know, like for me, it was like this thing of, you know, when I look at women, you think, wow, there's this beautiful woman there. And I saw that song, Just Like a Rainbow. Yeah, you think they're right there. But then if you analyze, if you look for them, they're not there. That's just like a rainbow. Same thing, it appears beautiful, it appears to be real and substantial.
Yeah, but when you collide with it, it's real and substantial. Just
except you can't collide with a rainbow. That's the thing. You can't ever find it. You can't catch it.
Other phenomena in the world, you know. Yeah.
Take the person that you collide with. Where is the person that you collide with?
Standing in front of me.
Okay. Let's have a person standing right in front of you. Identify the person. And you'd go, what's in front of me is a person, isn't it?
No, it's a thing. It's a body made up of parts and
that's right. So where's the person
to it? So,
no person there.
I can't get my head around that.
That's right. So
that's
what we've got to do. That's what we've got to do, Fran. Get our head around it so we can actually see the appearance is illusory.
I can understand my interpretation of what I see is illusory, and I can understand that it all comes from different parts and dependent arising and things like that. So you can, I suppose, negate that, but we still have to sort of exist within this sort of real world, you know. So even though I collide with something which identifies being a person.
So, Fran, when you're talking, I was just thinking today, I read this article about racism, for instance. So even when someone says there's a person there, we see everything through all these different veils. And so, like with racism, we'll see a lesser person or a scary person or a threat. And we just think, oh, that's reality, that's the real world. But that is not the real world. You can't find that person. So, and somebody else, if you knew them, you wouldn't see person, you'd see grandma, or you'd see my neighbor, or you'd see, you know, a refugee that came by boat, or a refugee that managed to get on a plane and get saved. So that's the thing, that we think there's person there, and we believe whatever that story is.
Yeah, but if I'm walking around aimlessly and I just think that thing over there doesn't exist, but it's actually a solid bit of flesh and blood and bone, and I sort of walk into it, it's not going to disappear and dissipate.
No, of course not.
So what do we call that then, Eddie?
Well, you might call it conventionally the person.
So conventionally I can still collide with something.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but okay. It's how you collide, because if you collide with someone who's an Asian or who's black and you're white, the way you collide with them is going to be very different.
Well, that's open to interpretation by others, I suppose.
So remember, when we So there's two things going on here. So when we look at the conventional phenomena, there's no analysis there. There's no deep analysis. We're not analyzing where the person ultimately exists. But conventional cognizers don't do that. That's not their job. That's a, this is what we say, persons exist conventionally. Do they exist ultimately, truly? Are they findable within the body and mind? All that sort of stuff, that's an ultimate analysis. And then you find, of course, they don't exist like that. So this is how you try and pull together the conventional and the ultimate. So you have conventionally, rainbows appear in the sky, depend upon the sun and the raindrops. And the most important thing, the naming process. Mm-hmm. You need to have a consciousness that goes, that's a rainbow.
And Eddie, I like that this example of, if we bump into someone with this example of attachment to the body, that like with women, the older you get, the more invisible you become. So you can actually be actually not seen at all, even though you are there, or literally bumped into you and everyone's like, where did you come from? Because you become more invisible the older that you get. So you don't even see when there's a conventional person there.
Yeah.
So one of the it's interesting, this was one of the I was talking before about, I've been taking a little bit of time to look at desirous attachment, and they have, the definition and the divisions. So you can have divisions in terms of time, in terms of entity and object. So you have attachment to those, desirous attachment to samsaric bodies, desirous attachment to samsaric enjoyments, and desirous attachment to samsaric places. So that's where you have your major, it goes in those three areas, your major areas of desirous attachment. So it's an interesting thing if you analyze the body to see if the body truly exists or exists in the way it appears to you, meaning existing from its own side. So like you say, if you see somebody in front of you, you'll see their body, won't you? Their body appears to you. It's got its color and its shape. And if you'd say, where is their body? Where is the body? You'd actually just go, right in front of me.
Well, there's a conventional body in front
of me. That's right. It's a conventional truth. And it's a conventional cognizer, and conventionally, you give that object the name body. But is there truly a body there? Is there a body from the side of what's appearing to you? No. If you look amongst, like I said, amongst the parts, there's no part of the person called body, and there's no body within the parts. So that's the illusory thing. And that's how you sort of use wisdom to overcome the attachment to the body. Or else you can use the methods to overcome attachment to the body. And the methods are usually impermanence and ugliness.
What was that?
Impermanence and ugliness.
Yeah. The sound's interesting because when you first started talking about desirous, it sounded like virus.
The virus attachment. That's, yes. Okay, let's move on then. So, question is, why should we not be worried about taking it a very long time to attain enlightenment? So this is material taking. I'll read you material first of all taking from Geshe Sopa. And then the Lamb Rim.
So, Eddie, just stop the screen share while you're reading.
Mm-hmm. This is, so bodhisattvas don't be discouraged about the amount of time, because they understand this causal relationship between actions and their results over time. They also understand that everything lacks an inherent nature and are like these magical illusions. And they use the wisdom to understand the illusory empty nature phenomena, which pushes down the wrong views. So one of the wrong views especially is like a sort of attachment to the body. But it's interesting when you have the idea about how does time exist. So we have a wrong view about what time is and how it exists. And if, you know, if you look for the substantial entity called time, there's nothing like that. You can't find the past, you can't find the future, and any time you try and find the present moment, so time exists as a mere imputation.
And also, Eddie, with time, what we're doing now is actually determining the future. So it's not even that the future is separate. It's
That's right. All these terms, future, present, past, are mental designations. They're just ideas and the words. Because if, you know, for all of us, isn't it? If we say we don't have any experience of the past ourselves, right? And none of the future. For us, it's always now. But so we think it's going to be a really long time, but the only time you ever experience any time is right now. But you can't find now. if you try and search it, you can't find it, right? So time's like illusory also. So no need to get freaked out about the long time it's going to take. You know, the sutras talk about eons and eons of time. That we have to practice in samsara. He says, but just as the place itself is not necessarily the cause of misery, neither is the length of time we remain there. But in general, if great suffering lasts even a short time, it's extremely troubling. But we have no problem with happiness lasting a long time. In fact, we'd like it to last even longer. Therefore, we should not be discouraged by the duration of time to complete the path. And in Lamrim Chemo, Lama Tsongkhapa says, don't be discouraged even by being delayed in cyclic existence for an immeasurable length of time. Because a long length of time is not in itself a reason to be disheartened. If suffering is extremely intense, even a brief period is disheartening. But if there's no suffering and you are happy, even a long time is not disheartening.
So, Eddie, is this because it's a Mahayana thing, that like if we're trying to get out of suffering, cyclic existence for personal liberation, it can seem like just get me out of here, but if we're on the Mahayana path and we love everybody, then we're happy to be with them. We're not trying to get away from everyone. We're trying to help them. So, you know, as a Mahayana thing, then it's of course we feel happy because we love all sentient beings.
That's true, and it's like a subsidiary thing, an extra.
A supporting
thing.
Yeah. Okay.
But what really makes it not a problem is that time lacks inherent existence. Time doesn't have any true existence. Yeah, and that works from the person seeking individual liberation or the person seeking the Mahayana enlightenment. Time does not have any true existence. So a long length of time is no problem. And so that's what I was saying before, is that it's not so much what you said, even though that contributes to making it not a problem. The real problem is like grasping to time as if it had true existence. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, there's no problem. Like mm-hmm. I said, all we really experience is right now, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and we're always saying, oh, my gosh, the last 10 years went by in a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
So maybe the countless, three countless great eons will go by in a blink of an eye too.
Yeah, and like, you know, when you're about 7 years old, you look at people who are 70, like some of us are, or very close to it, it seems like a massive amount of time, doesn't it? Yet when you're 70, you look back, it's a blink of an eye. So, yeah, time's relative. Times are relative.
Eddie.
Yep.
I still don't know how to work this thing. Does that not seem it's Jeanette.
Yeah, Jeanette. I'll just come back.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's me. It's not you. Now, where are you, Jeanette? Let's have a look.
Yep. I haven't got the video on because... does that just now sound just a wee bit contradictory? When you think of what we're taught, you know, when we do the death meditation, that time is off of the essence. You know, we don't have a long time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's it appears that way, but in fact, it's not. It's not that way because when we're meditating on death, it's done from the point of view of the lower scope. Right, so it's like the beginner type of it's the beginner's practice, and it's encouraging. It's like start right now. You don't have much time. Death exists, and it mm-hmm. does, doesn't it? So we need to engage like now, like get a move on.
Yeah, right. I'm just sitting here.
So
thinking.
There, so that person, you are worried about time.
Yeah, that's right.
But then when you come up to the later part. Then you meet the Mahayana and you go, oh my, three great eons to do this. The amount of time is immense, you know. Now, so then you get worried about it.
Uh-huh.
The antidote is given. No need to worry about it for these reasons.
All right, that's good to know.
Yeah. So the thing is, so the whole path is sort of like this. It's highly dependent. You know, so they'll say one level here, be afraid. And over here, no need to be afraid. Get worried about time, you don't have much. Over here, don't worry about it. Because these instructions are given at different points of the path.
All right, yeah.
And not only that, but you know more.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, thank you.
Okay, let's go on our little thingy. So the question is it too difficult for us to complete the two collections of merit and wisdom? So simply said, you might think it is, but then actually the answer is no. So here Geshe Sopa says, the prospect of eons upon eons of work to accumulate merit and wisdom can be discouraging. However, there's no need to be disheartened. Although a measureless accumulation of wholesome activity is needed, with proper understanding, we will see that it too is not difficult. So what I think you can be able to see here is that without much analysis, without investigation, sort of new, it certainly does appear difficult. It can even appear impossible. But then, we're introduced to some more reasoning and new ways of looking, and you go, oh, okay. You know, and then we change our mind, go, okay, I get it. So I think that's quite common, that we should just accept that that's how it is. We will see things one way originally, and we should acknowledge that and be honest about that, and then look at the reasons, and then we can go, oh, I get it. Then we can lay that doubt down. But we need to acknowledge our doubts about this material. Just because we don't know much, you know, we don't know enough. Then we get introduced to more knowledge and we deal with the doubt. So Geshe Tashi Tsering says, we're encouraged not to worry because after all, the thing we're seeking to achieve here Buddhahood has limitless qualities. And we set out to achieve this Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Think about the Buddhahood you're striving for. Think about its limitless qualities. And think about how when you do that, you accumulate limitless merit. And also think about the sentient beings we're trying to achieve that enlightenment for. Friends, neutral people, enemies, like everyone, they're also immeasurable. So sentient beings are as limitless as space, so innumerable that they are countless, and that while working for their benefit and striving to achieve enlightenment to alleviate their suffering, then again you actually gather limitless merit. So although in order to achieve enlightenment we must gather the limitless collections, we are engaged in these, acts through which limitless merit and so forth are accrued. That's what makes it sort of easy. So yeah, the goal is like limitless enlightenment, but that's great because sentient beings are limitless. So then we put our wish on it, then the merit becomes limitless. So no worries about collecting limitless merit to get limitless enlightenment for limitless sentient beings. So it's not a problem. Focusing on the limitless qualities of Buddhahood and limitless sentient beings, for whose sake we are striving, gathers in the limitless collections necessary for enlightenment. So that's nice, isn't it? And I was just thinking also too, well, how we find these, we make difficulties for ourselves through seeing part of the picture. Yeah, and then the mind reifies that part, and then it's problem, big problem. Like I say, you know, so we see like limitless merit we need to collect. And so that's one part of it, isn't it? The limitless merit. Well, then we forget it's about limitless Buddhahood and limitless sentient beings and the wish being limitless, that's how it's done. Right? But if we just take one part, it's problematic. We need to, remind ourselves of the dependent arising of the thing, how parts make up a whole, and have another shot at it. Limitless beings, limitless qualities, limitless merit.
So Eddie, that one, it's often like when we think, we remember limitless beings, but we forget we have limitless Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to draw on to help us.
Yeah.
We forget that the merit that we make is also limitless. So we often focus just on the overwhelmingness of all sentient beings and forget about the rest, that it's equally big to match it.
Yeah, well, that's like it focuses on the limitless merit. That's impossible. But then you've forgotten, like you said, the limitless sentient beings that you have to draw upon to gather that merit. Yeah, so if you miss out, if you just take one part, like I said, it becomes problematic. Next slide. So the question is, what are the three instructions Lama Tsongkhapa gives us in relationship to making limitless merit, developing the limitless qualities, and depends upon the limitless beings? So anybody, any ideas, anyone? The question again, what are the three instructions Lama Tsongkhapa gives us in relationship to this great difficulty in terms of completing the two collections of merit and wisdom? Oh, Kate's here.
Could it be to sort of remember our intrinsic Buddha nature within ourselves, that we do have that potential, remembering that?
That's a good thing to remember, but in this case, It's not included in the 3 points of the instruction.
Well, I haven't read the book.
I've got down here compassion, mind of enlightenment, and loving kindness. I'm not sure if that was the list of three that's relevant for this question.
Okay.
From Geshe Tashi Sering's commentary. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's put up the slide. So this answer comes from Lamrim Chenmo, page 193 and paragraph 1. So he says first, motivate, focus, and this one here. So he says, first of all, motivate yourself with the desire to attain the goal of limitless Buddha qualities for the welfare of the limitless beings you intend to help. I'll say it again. First, motivate yourself with the desire to attain the goal of limitless Buddha qualities for the welfare of the limitless beings you intend to help. Then, next, focus on remaining in cyclic existence for a measureless period and take the bodhisattva vows. So, measureless period, take the bodhisattva vows, thinking, I shall accomplish the limitless collections. Then, if you keep the vows, whether your mind is distracted by other things or not, asleep or awake, you will constantly accumulate merit as vast as space. So I guess it's like you said before, Fran, so acknowledge that you have the nature, Buddha nature, so it's possible to become, to have the qualities of the Buddha. You can remain for others. And then, like you were saying, Bruce, on the basis of great loving kindness and compassion, take the bodhisattva vow. Next question is, what are the four immeasurable ways mentioned in the quote from the precious garland? So this is a simple one, I think. It's immeasurable time, immeasurable sentient beings, immeasurable enlightenment, and immeasurable wholesome actions or virtue. The Geshe Sopa says on page 449, accumulating all the merit necessary to attain enlightenment is therefore discouraging only when we cannot get beyond our egocentric view. Isn't that a good one? It's true, isn't it? It's really discouraging when we can't get past egocentrism. While we are subject to selfish concerns, it seems impossible to do anything for all sentient beings. But if we develop bodhicitta, we will not feel worried or be overcome by adversity. In every moment, we will accumulate as much merit and purify as much negative karma as there are sentient beings. There are four immeasurable things: time, sentient beings, the highest realizations of the goal, and wholesome actions. With these four incalculable things, don't you think that we can attain enlightenment in not too long a time?
Actually, Eddie, now it comes to mind too, in Bendigo, how Venerable Gyatso said, we've got to remember that in terms of those three countless great eons, we're right at the end. We're just about finished them. We're not at the beginning. Mm. We're almost there completing it.
Yep, that's the skillful way to think about it. So we've next question. Interesting one. She says, there are two possible motivations for wishing to attain enlightenment, which are outlined by Lama Tsongkhapa. And one is good and the other is not so good. Explain the good motivation. Right? So this is one you probably all know, and it's the simplest one, isn't it? So what have we got here? So because you are moved by the very intense power of your loving kindness, compassion, and mind of enlightenment, it is most wonderful to think, if only I could attain Buddhahood in a brief time for the sake of living beings. So again, Geshe Sopa says we must distinguish between the various reasons for wanting enlightenment as soon as possible. The essence of the Mahayana attitude is to want enlightenment quickly, because only by becoming a Buddha can we alleviate suffering beings, sentient beings suffering. We want the quickest possible path to enlightenment, because sentient beings have been suffering from beginningless time and cannot wait any longer. So this attitude will bring enlightenment quickly, and the mindset is a marvelous thing, and we should strive to cultivate it. Geshe Tashi Tsering says, let's say that a person develops loving kindness, compassion, the mind of enlightenment, and develops them so that they're very, very strong. They become very, very firm in their mind. And they become moved by the very intense power of their loving kindness, compassion, and the mind of enlightenment. Due to the fierceness and firmness of these attitudes, then they think, if only I could attain Buddhahood in a brief time for the sake of living beings. In that case, developing the attitude is most wonderful, and it would be the correct way.
Can I just ask the question here? So when we're wanting to attain enlightenment, it's still to stay within samsara anyway, to help all beings, not to attain enlightenment, go off to a pure land somewhere, because we can't do much there.
Just say again, please. You can do stuff from even from the pure lands.
Yeah. But it's really that you need to remain in cyclic existence in that purified state to be able to help all beings. You can't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you want to remain wherever there are sentient beings, helping sentient beings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, it's staying in samsara, though. But it's not going to trouble us as badly.
The tricky thing is to remember, like, what do we mean by samsara here? So what we do not mean is that our mind is of a samsaric state and we're staying in samsara.
Right.
So that's not what the bodhisattvas is doing, are they? Bodhisattvas are trying to purifying their mind, come back into samsara and go, hey, it's easy, and I'm going to keep on helping.
So, Eddie, actually what we're aiming for is non-abiding nirvana.
Yeah, that's right.
Aiming for, samsara is going to be okay if I'm helping others. We're going for non-abiding nirvana.
We can have it but not be there.
Yeah, that's right. We don't experience the samsaric states. Samsara here, when we talk about it like this, is that we know others are experiencing samsara. We will help them.
Yeah, because otherwise, if you have that wrong thought that, oh God, I'm still going to be here, it might actually be a handbrake too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, so there it's very important again to know who the person is when we say, oh God, I'm going to be there. You're going to have to go, well, hang on a minute. When you talk about yourself in that way, how are you perceiving yourself? Because if you're grasping itself, then you've got problems again. So it's not going to be the self that is grasped at to exist that's going to be in samsara. If the grasping is taking place, you're in samsara. You're a samsaric being. So you come back in knowing how you exist, mere imputation upon a body and a mind and so forth. So there's no grasping happening there. So remember, the bodhisattva is going along. They've entered the path of seeing. So they've knocked out a heap of problematic stuff. But they would have gone up further into the path, so the mind is becoming more and more and more refined, getting closer and closer to Buddhahood. They're still coming back into cyclic existence because they're not going to experience problems like normal people do, and they're going to help others. And even when they're attained enlightenment as Buddhas, same thing, then they just do the emanations, don't they?
Eddie, could I ask you something?
Sure.
A couple of weeks ago, Willie and I were sitting at an outdoor cafe having a cup of tea, and this young fellow went by, a big sturdy fella, but there was something wrong with him. You could see the way he was walking, his foot was turned in, and you could just see he had something mentally wrong with him. And I got a knot in my stomach when I looked at him, and I thought, oh, the poor soul, what a shame. And it upset me, still upset me when I think about it. So my question is, if I become enlightened and I come back to samsara, how can I help him? How can I actually help him?
So the major way would be to introduce him to the teachings and encourage him to take them up.
But if he's got he's got a mental state, he doesn't have the ability.
Well, it's like suddenly I think of the story of the pigeon. Right? So the pigeon used to come out of Vasubandhu's window and listen to him recite, and Vasubandhu would see the pigeon just recite to him. Person took rebirth into the human realm and had all these great he could memorize the Dharma and so forth, and his life was as good as a human being.
But also,
there's also the story of the fly that went around on the piece of
from dung
to cow paddy,
cow pat to cow pat around the stupa.
Around the stupa.
But Eddie, there's another thing too. Geshe Zopa often says, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche too, that if we bless our speech and if we say that prayer, everyone who sees me, thinks of me, looks at me, remembers me, even in anger, may they always be connected to the Dharma. May they be, liberated from all of their sufferings, purify all of their negative seeds and attain enlightenment, complete the path to enlightenment, So you have that every time you leave the house, every time you go out into the world, you have that prayer. Then your very existence becomes a bridge for that person. So when you see someone like that, you've made a karmic connection. And through the strength of your prayer, that karmic connection isn't just a samsaric one, but it can link that person to the Dharma.
All right.
Yeah. I was just thinking, as you said that story, the story, Jeanette, about the point when Buddha was a prince and then he saw the lioness and her cubs. So then he opened up his veins and gave them his blood and had allowed them to eat him. And his intention for doing this was say, in a future life, may you guys become my five disciples. And so you look at them and you go, okay, so I've met a human being that walks down the street with a club foot and so forth. That human being is in a better state than the lioness and her cubs. Right? So, and you're there, if you've got this, the mind of enlightenment and so forth, or even enlightened, you're of benefit to them. But also remember, like it is highly dependent upon the other person. The other person also has to do something.
Yeah, well, I'm just, that boy probably never even saw me sitting there.
Yeah, that's right.
Him walking by had an immense effect on me for weeks after. I couldn't stop thinking about him because he was so disabled and he was a big, big, sturdy boy. Yeah. I just wondered if he'd had an accident or something. So if it depends on him as well, how can I sort of make an imprint in his mind?
A lot of the times, when the lamas see kitties and they always give them lollies and they just make this connection. And we just think, oh, it's just a lama giving a kitty a lolly. But actually what they're doing is far more profound than that. They're making that connection so that from the side of the child, they go, oh, there's, and they have an acknowledgement. So from their side, there's a connection.
Yeah, Lama Yeshe riding in the trains and the coaches of the trains where the poorest people were, just so they could see him and make a connection.
Yeah, that's right.
But so even at that level, but then if you go further and were to teach them something or suggest something that would be useful to them is even, you know, even a bit more, isn't it?
It's just sometimes I get a bit down because I think there's just so much suffering. And
yeah, there is.
It's just horrible to see some people the way they have to live. It's terrible.
So, like a lot of this, so it's this thing of being, that's true. And so, I think a couple of weeks ago, last week, we were talking about the different forms of discouragement. So discouragement at one level is fine, but then you have to get rid of it.
Otherwise, I've had a hard time coming to the class this morning because I've been just feeling a bit down and I thought, oh, what's the point? And then I start to think, well, this is what the class is about, joy's perseverance. So I managed to make it this morning, but I'll tell you, I had a struggle to get to this class this morning. I was thinking a lot of negative things.
But I do feel
better now that I'm here. I do feel better.
So this is, like we're saying, at the beginning, Jeanette, we've got to find the things that discourage us and hinder practice and then work against it, which is what you've done.
That's right.
Mm. Yeah. It's not easy being a Dharma person. You're really working against, it's easy to work against your husband or kids or somebody else out there, isn't it? Just open your mouth and start talking. But to work against your own stuff, that's hard work.
Yeah,
And it can be discouraging. And yet if we bow down to the discouragement, if we allow discouragement to win, it doesn't do any good for us.
No, that's right.
And that's also what they say in the text, isn't it? If you allow discouragement to win, you lose.
Yeah. And I've kept thinking of that statement last week about when you say to yourself, I can't do this, I just can't do it. Mm-hmm. You've got to convince yourself that you can do it.
Yeah, that's right.
And just go on with it. So
yeah.
I think I can do that.
Yeah, well, if you can say remember that story. If a fly going around on a cow patty around a stupa can become enlightened, Jesus, why can't I?
Yeah.
Like Chris has written, thank you. It's good to be honest. I mean, we're a small group, we can be honest with one another, and that's the point, isn't it? We don't want to hide away our failings. So you've got to bring them into the light and deal with them.
Isn't that why we're here? Isn't that why we're trying to? I was just saying to Malcolm in the break, I said, coming to these sessions is much better than me going to see a psychologist because there's stuff that's spoken about that, we can have genuine feelings and genuine doubts without sort of, having some sort of CBT thrown at us or something like that, So, the reality is, even though it's been an effort for you to get here this morning, you still came and there you sort of rejoice, and say thumbs up. Jeanette.
Thumbs up, Jeanette.
Thank you.
And also, Jeanette, don't forget, even Arya Chenrezig, even Thousand Arm Chenrezig got discouraged, right? And so when he got discouraged, he had a nervous breakdown, and the nervous breakdown manifested as turning into all those heads, more heads to be able to help more sentient beings. So it's like even the best of us, right, even the bodhisattvas become discouraged, but they don't go, oh, well, therefore I failed. Even discouragement's on the path then.
Mm. I was watching a tape of His Holiness the Dalai Lama giving a teaching, and at the end of the teaching he quoted that verse that he always does, for as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings, I too will remain, and he put his head down and he went, I too will remain, and I burst into tears.
Yes.
I just think I'm just getting too sensitive to things now, and
you're waking.
That's something worth goodness. Crying over.
Yeah.
That's a really good thing to cry over.
Oh, I didn't think it was. I thought, oh, here we go again. No, all right, sorry to take up so much time.
You know, Jeanette, other people cried over the stock market, but if you cried over His Holiness's dedication, that's good.
Okay.
And then we come to the second motivation. This is the wrong one, you know, the one that's not so good. And to sum it up, Lama Tsongkhapa says, when you are not within the sphere of that other motivation, and you see the necessity of a very long training and endless deeds, and that much hard work is required, you might think, if this is the case, who could possibly do it? Kinsa Rinpoche says, a person who sees the necessity of the very long training and endless deeds, and that much hard work, thinks, if this is the case, who could possibly do it? If that person then seeks a quicker path, that person would directly damage the engaged mind of enlightenment and indirectly damage the aspirational mind of enlightenment. Geshe Sopa says, we see a long, long period of incalculable work. Worrying about our own difficulties, we look for something easier, a shortcut for ourselves. This selfish attitude hinders us from accomplishing our goal, because it indirectly damages aspirational bodhicitta and directly spoils active bodhicitta. Not wanting to try something that appears so difficult keeps us from starting to develop bodhicitta. It's the precise opposite of active bodhicitta. So this is the wrong motivation. Being discouraged that enlightenment requires very long training and endless deeds, I shall seek a quicker path to Buddhahood. So I confess to doing this. I've always looked for, like, can we do it faster? Is there some quicker method? And of course you find there is a quicker method, but the thing is you can't use it with this type of understanding. Not because you're discouraged. That's not the attitude to take. There is a quicker method, but you don't take it because you're discouraged. That's the wrong idea. So the damage done, if you think in the secondary way, is you indirectly damage the aspirational bodhicitta, you directly damage engaging bodhicitta, the lineage of the Mahayana is weakened, and the idea of enlightenment fades away.
So, Eddie, I don't quite get how you could do it out of discouragement. Like, I can't imagine what that kind of motivation would be. Like,
the motivation is, I've got to find a simpler way of doing it. Like if you work through, right, and you go, okay, so this Buddhism seems really interesting. That sounds like freedom. That's great. The goals are fantastic. Okay, I'll go for it. I'm going to have a go at it. Then you see, okay, if you do it the bodhisattva path, which we're all introduced to, which has these perfections in it, it's going to take you three countless great eons. It's going to take you one countless great eon just to get the mind of enlightenment. Then it's going to take a great eon to go from the path of accumulation, accumulation, preparation, path of seeing, another great eon. Then it's going to take you the next eon to bring yourself to enlightenment. And you ask, how long is the great eon? And you go, well, yeah, the whole universe has got to sort of come to an end and then restart again and then come to an end and restart again and come to an end. So you look at all that and then you go, that's the time, and this is what you're going to be doing within that time. So then it's like, that's all so these beings, all in the mind of enlightenment. Surely there's got to be some. I can't do it.
But isn't that the fear of? Isn't that like either a fear or a procrastination or laziness by using that as an excuse?
Yeah, it's a form of laziness. Yeah.
So is this a long way round of saying you lose your Mahayana motivation, that you just go, oh, it's too much to do that, I'm just going to go for self-liberation. Is that what you're saying?
No, not self-liberation, else? For enlightenment. But so you got the first part right. It's like, you know, you still look at this, go like it's too much. So then you, like they're saying, the mind of enlightenment weakens because now it's like me. It's about me. Right now you're first. Remember the mind was, okay. Oh, others are first. I come second.
So this happens a lot in life of our motivations kind of being a bit degenerated, that we start off all big-hearted, then we lose our energy, and then we become, the balance shifts and we're more aware of our lack of energy than our what our goal was. Is that what it's saying? That it, so we still got a Mahayana goal, but
actually it's not supported by compassion, great compassion, right? Or the love for all sentient beings. It becomes more about our own personal desire, our own personal liberation. So I'm going to find a quicker way for me to become enlightened.
But isn't that why we go on the tantric path?
Yes, but it's not for me. It's for sentient beings.
Yeah,
it's for
right.
Sentient beings, right. Okay.
That's the real crucial thing. So that thing of when people do go, oh, that's right, okay, tantric path, and then it's all about me on the tantric path, damage happening.
Yeah.
And so then is the safety the thing that keeps us safe then, the four immeasurable attitudes?
Well, I think you can find there's a lot of safety you could call upon, but it means you have to sort of backtrack.
Uh-huh, okay. Right, because, I mean, just in, you know, day-to-day life in a Dharma centre, many times the motivation for a tantric initiation has this damage in there of it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, both, you know, if you look at the West, for most people, I think even in the monasteries, you don't have a great deal of knowledge about the path. Yeah, for most people, I'm sure, before they take a high sloka tantric initiation, they haven't spent a lot of time like on the lam rim, right? The foundation. And so what will often happen is you'll meet people who will ask you, are you going to go and do this initiation? I'm going. No, the teachers say, it's a good idea to do this thing. Right? So if you think about that, it's like, so the desire there is really about oneself becoming enlightened and taking this quick path for the benefit of sentient beings comes second.
Yeah, and then the result is you get the initiation, then you go, oh, no, the commitment.
That's right, this is too hard. That's right.
Whereas the commitment's actually the work for sentient beings.
Yes, whereas if you'd gone the other way, but which takes a great deal of time and thinking and trouble, isn't it, to go, you know, the first thought is, yeah, I need to become, you know, liberate myself from cyclic existence. Of course, and you need to do that. You want to do that. But then you see everybody else in the same state. Yeah, and then on that basis, develop, you know, six causes and one effect, or equalizing, exchanging self for others, and da da da, so that others become more important. So, for the sake of others, I'll become enlightened. But most times it goes, no, I will become enlightened for the sake of others. So that the focus is put more on me than the sentient beings. So then, like I said, the lineage weakens, enlightenment fades, especially when you see all these intractable sentient beings, the limitless time, the limitless methods. Like, you know, so you can see how it could damage it, couldn't you?
Just a question, Eddie.
Sure.
So this comes under the stopping discouragement because wherever you are is a place to practice. So I don't quite understand why this sort of we're talking about comes under that discouragement when we're, the previous discouragement is about to obtain the goal. So what we're talking about here is like we're falling back to a Hinayana motivation.
Well, we're talking about like being in cyclic existence. So the place is cyclic existence.
Right. So discouragement from being in cycling existence for so long or something. Yeah.
Okay, so the last two questions are really nice, simple, straight ones. So I've got the two trailblazers, often called the two charioteers. So you'll find these terms often mentioned. So these trailblazers are Nagarjuna, the middle way, and Asanga, the mind only. So these are the two different attendance systems. Like I said, often called the charioteers or the trailblazers. And finally, the instructions from Arya Asanga were know the methods without discouragement. And finally, don't be satisfied with minimal qualities. And these two answers were in relation to the question, what are the two instructions Arya Asanga gives us about how we should make progress? So always remember, when it comes to the methods, without a great deal of knowledge, it's easy to become discouraged. But knowledge will work against discouragement. So I think it's, you know, Kenshin was always saying, isn't he? Study, study, study. So study means like hearing, reading, just some way of getting the information into you and then taking time to contemplate it, taking time to think about it. And when you see that, this is the answer, so I have no need to be discouraged, then meditate on that. But really become familiar with, I don't need to be discouraged about this because I know this. So in brief, today we had these 14 questions and they're all about, you know, the method of development. Look at their answers. Oh, look at this. I'm sorry, folks, I didn't do the slide. but
we've and I'm read, sorry I didn't pick it up either.
Yeah, we're teaching 9, so if you're not familiar with it, just read it over again. There's just material in Geshe Sopa's book and Lama Tsongkhapa's book. So the place we've stopped at, and that we do in teaching 10. So teaching 10 next week is gathering the forces of the favorable conditions. And that's on page 195. So if you read from page 194 backwards for a few pages. Stopping discouragement about the means to attain the goal. Yeah. So from page 190 to 194 for the Lamrim Chenma. And it'll be something to page 452 in Geshe Sopa's work. So I'm sorry about that. We both missed it. So thank you for making Sunday meaningful and useful and great to have your company. So it's good to have something.
Time flew, talking about no inherent existence of time. Time flew, didn't it?
I suppose we're not grasping at it. Okay. We've created some merit here studying the perfections. May they help us to perfect joyously persevering in the path to enlightenment for the sake of others. And by doing so, may this repay in some way the kindness of our teachers, our mothers and fathers, our parents, in fact, all sentient beings who have been kind to us and helped us have this life that we've got now. So I dedicate, just like Samantha Bhadra and Mute Manjushri did, knowing that everything exists in mere name, so we want to achieve mere enlightenment for the sake of mere beings. That came back quickly. Thank you, everyone.